thought it was a pretty interesting episode this week. What did we get to?
We talked a lot about OpenAI and then talked about it some more and some more.
We did. We tried to balance the line of really not knowing what the F is going on, but we did our best to try and put a few pieces together and share some ideas that I don't think others have been discussing.
I think some insights there around boards, dysfunctional boards, and some insights for founders as well. Hopefully there's some value for listeners.
I want to reiterate my apology again for some of the way I described the board members, but we'll leave it at that.
And our discussion on boards led us to quickly touching on Rugby Australia and the shift with the chair.
Yeah.
That was shift with an F, not shit with this board. Then moving on back onto AI, we talked a lot about how to survive and thrive in the world of AI after a podcast from 20 BC with some interesting insights for founders of how to think about navigating the changing technology landscape.
Yeah, no, that was great, which was flowed in nicely, just some news out about the Australian ecosystem.
Yeah, so looking at some stats around the ecosystem, the fact that our tech unicorns are defying the global odds and performing well on the global stage. We ended with a little shout out to Technology One and their continued success with 14 years in a row of record profit and revenues.
All right, let's get into it. Morning.
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 How are you doing?
Sensational. I'm feeling good.
Doesn't sound like it.
How are you, Don?
Good. Enjoying the rain. Got a lot of grass to try and get green. Next year, I'm hosting my sister's wedding. And there's a lot of work to occur and new grass is being sown and new areas being developed. So I'm very much looking forward to all of this rain as much as everybody keeps complaining about it.
Oh, no, it's long overdue. We need it. How are you going, Jack?
Yeah, I'm going good. I think I missed the rain. So I flew out to Adelaide the day the rain started. And then I came to Adelaide and it's been really good weather. So I'm lucky.
I always enjoyed with my time down in Adelaide, Jack, the summers because the grass turned into corn chips.
Yeah.
And you would just be crunch, crunch with that really dry heat.
Yeah. It's like the grass is already turning to corn chips. It's already going yellow.
That was Cairns on the weekend. So they haven't had rain for a while, although it did rain up there yesterday. But just so
it's
weird.
Similar to the wet season. Winter was wet when it's supposed to be dry, which if you are dumb enough to part own a caravan park up in that region, you're just tethered a little bit to the weather because you want the dry weather in winter, so all of the grey nomads and Mexicans arrive. Now the wet season is dry, so that's weird.
It's inverted. I was going to suggest, Don, that we host the Tribe Chrissy party up there, maybe the week before Chrissy. But if you're saying the grass isn't there, then maybe not.
When we bought it, one of the last reviews was that this would be a really good place to shoot meth. And I'm pleased to say that we're now, I think, a 9.7 average on booking.com and a 9.8 on Wikicamps. So the millions of dollars that's gone into reinvestment is paying off. But yeah, good idea. And anybody that's caravanning or wants a cabin in far north Queensland, hit me up. Special tribe discount of 2.6%.
I guess that's the thing about Google reviews is it doesn't actually matter who's leaving the review so long as it's a high review.
And I reject any suggestions that I have a review farm in Southeast Asia doing random reviews. Let's get into it, eh? I think we couldn't possibly start without talking about OpenAI.
No, absolutely. I couldn't believe it. It's actually day six of OpenAI. What do we call it? It's not even a saga. It's like a reality TV show.
I think in the world that we live in, things can fall apart so quickly and they're falling apart quicker and quicker and a couple of wrong moves and before you know it, the whole thing's blown up in a matter of days and it seems to be coming par for the course.
Yeah, one of the most hilarious things I saw on Twitter. The internet is so great in these moments, but there was the analogy of Steve Jobs making a comeback after, what was it, 12 years? And when Sam Altman was rumored to return after something like 12 hours, it was like, this is the TikTok generation. Time frames have reduced.
This is just the speed that everything... A bit of a recap. So what was it, Saturday? I think, yeah, it was Saturday morning because I was coming back from my Saturday morning mammalage and Sam Altman's been fired and it just kicked off an absolute whirlwind from there. And I thought this episode was going to be wildly speculating on all sorts of things and we were just going to totally make everything up. But I think the situation's become reasonably clear now. Something happened that the board didn't really like, and that something happened seems to have been Sam looking at some other opportunities in the chip space, or just generally spending time doing other things that isn't the CEO of OpenAI. There was obviously some view that wasn't appropriate, and somehow that led to him being fired, and I think a whiplash that the board doesn't seem to have thought through, given the main driver of Sam's firing then came back and said, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. It wasn't the right thing to do. I didn't think it through, even though I'm on the board of a $90 billion fucking company and I'm supposed to be competent."
I think that's a pretty good summary just right there. Like, I just think it was only a couple of weeks ago, right? Sam Altman on the stage announcing all the latest features of ChatGPT and that high of highs. And so it was quite a shock. And the official reasoning of what was it? Inconsistently candid with the board.
Inconsistent communications with the board. And they've still not come out and explain. And throughout the weekend and Monday, my view was that this was going to end up as an Occam's razor kind of situation where the simplest answer is going to come to the top. Because if there was some really bad behavior, some real nefarious stuff, at very least, even if boards aren't doing it for the right reason, they like to virtue signal on how morally superior they are. And none of that sort of came out. So to me, there was something that wasn't very nefarious. And I think that's turning out to be true, given what's happened now with Microsoft and the way that board members have recanted and everything else.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a basic thing of a very naive board. By the sounds of it, took no outside counsel, had no crisis PR, didn't talk to Microsoft, didn't talk to the staff, didn't do any of this stuff. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and to your point, if there was something truly nefarious going on, boards move to protect themselves. There's a lot of ask protection normally, and there was none of that. And even the fact that investors didn't know what was going on, Microsoft are rumored to have only heard minutes before Sam Altman was actually fired and removed. But the COO, days later, still didn't have clarity on what was happening or why he'd been fired. So I think that
they appointed an interim, and then they got the guy from Twitch, who by all accounts is a nice guy, but what?
Yeah, exactly. So even if the decision is made at a board level, the communication of that, the management of the news, the succession planning required, there was just absolutely no consideration for basic fundamental steps of good management and good governance.
OpenAI was born out of an idea and structurally has a problem, which is there's this for-purpose aspect and the profit aspect. And the purpose aspect and the profit aspect are in conflict. And it was born as this company with some ideals, and it's turned into this massive rocket ship. And one of the things I think in the last episode we talked about, the needing to build foundations as your company scales. And what we've got here is a board that I think was born out of some small idea and then found themselves atop of one of the most generationally significant companies. And there's an Aussie involved here, Helen Toner, and I've heard her described as an academic activist. Boards need to have a range of skill sets and need to have different energies, and an academic activist, I'm sure, could add some value, but their academia and real world experience tend not to go hand in hand. Forecasting the significant issues that might come from a decision, and activists in general that are very passionate about a problem. If you think of the is, one should view of the world that we've discussed a few times, they concentrate on what should be, what they want, and they almost become militant around that. And it's black and white, no shades of gray, shouldn't behave like this. And the best decision would be to get rid of him and find someone that can live up to the ideals. And that kind of thinking, whilst maybe morally correct and morally superior, and there doesn't seem to be any balancing of what's the upside from what we're about to do and what's the downside from what we're about to do, and have we we thought through it properly and have we put the right steps in place? It's just, to me, what it smells like is absolute naivety, absolute inexperience for people that found themselves on the top of a rocket ship that didn't have the experience and knowledge to know how to handle it.
Yeah, and a board that seems more on the academic side definitely doesn't appear that commercial, and a CEO who's highly commercial. And it's interesting, I remember back in, it would have been 2016, being in Silicon Valley and hearing that there was a lot of content coming up from Sam Altman and Musk, who was originally on the board of OpenAI, talking about the genesis of OpenAI, and it was about making sure that AI code was open source, for that no one company could own AI, and it was for the protection of humanity and all these kind of idealisms. And fast forward to today, significant commercial operation with a lot of rumors around products being released. And I was listening to something the other day talking about some of the engineers saying that they were really surprised by some of the outcomes that the AI was generating, and they're not even fully sure how this thing is working. And yet here it is released into the wild. So there is a compromise of those principles that were there at the genesis to now being this, you know, huge commercial operation.
Yeah. And it smells to me that there was absolutely this undertone of purpose and moral righteousness. But the problem is the high moral ground is often lonely and expensive. But you've got to choose what path you want to go down. You're either a for purpose with these unbelievably high moral ideals that repels capitalistic intent, or you're more on the business side. It's just really hard to be both.
Yeah, and there's a structural element at play here too, which we'll get to, that conflict and tension between the two.
Yeah. But yeah. What did you think, Jack, when you were watching it all play out?
Oh, just made me think how unpredictable the world is. Like, we looked at Sam Altman at the dev day on top of the world, and then all of this came out on Saturday. Absolutely crazy. But
it underlines that don't try and predict anything in life. Just be really good at responding to change and just being able to go with the flow, and don't measure the outcome, measure your ability to process whatever shit gets thrown at you.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. John, what are your thoughts? You were saying you can't play in both worlds, non-for-profit and profit. Clearly, when they started out in 2015, they were a non-for-profit dedicated to helping the humanity build AI safely. But now, since introducing the paid version of ChatGPT, it's clearly a for-profit purpose. And I think the underlying reasoning there was to help fund the operating expenses because of the models. Is your thoughts like there should have been a clear governance change, and therefore Microsoft, the investors, would have come on, done the typical terms of what a VC would do?
I think to begin with, we can't be so black and white to say you can't be both, because there are for-profit purpose-led businesses. I guess the best we can say is it's really hard.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I find it difficult to invest in for-purpose profit businesses because of that inherent conflict. But there are people that, you know, are in the ecosystem that we dearly love, we dearly support. But from a business model point of view, having been part of a couple, and it's just hard. So it's not that you shouldn't, it's just, and maybe we're a bit lazy. But I think it comes back to some of the stuff we've always discussed, that don't measure, I guess, time, so to speak, as much as more as development along a life cycle. And when you are aboard a rocket ship, you've got to really work to improve your systems and process. Now, clearly, I'd say the board has been operating like a very small startup board. If they didn't forecast what was going to happen here, if they didn't engage, if they didn't have external counsel, if they didn't see the need for PR and crisis PR support. And even now, they still haven't come out and been explicit. And I think the reason why they haven't come out and been explicit is the reason is so probably dumb and stupid and embarrassing. And this board doesn't survive. But the human impulse is them sitting there going, I don't want to be remembered as the people that totally fucked up OpenAI. So I'm going to, in my own self-interest, try and fix this.
Yeah.
But they never get to that point of actually fixing it. And so that's where improving governance, building the systems, building the processes, and at some point realizing that there was going to be this conflict, and maybe they had to structurally change. Maybe OpenAI needed to actually totally split up and create the entity that was just to do with the whole for-purpose protection against AI, making sure AI was healthy and all of that, and separate the business aspect and not try and have the same governance structures, because they're different structures, different energies, different purposes. But the problem is that would have been at somebody's self-interest expense, and humans, once they find themselves into powerful positions, they tend not to want to hand over that power. And there's just this big disconnect. I don't know if it's a disconnect, but there's part of the world that thinks AI is just this existential threat and we're in deep trouble. And then there's the, nah, calm down, she's going to be sweet crew. And the problem is that they're fairly polarized. And as we see with politics, religion, anything, polarized groups of people don't make for good bedfellows.
No. I think I'm just going to load up the organizational structure. How do I share this one? This is the structure of OpenAI. And I have so many questions how this came about. But looking at it, there's some issues here around the fact that there's these the board of directors sat over the top of a public charity, which owned the holding company of the non-profit aspect. The OpenAI LLC part, which was the profit generating, sits over on the side. And meanwhile, Microsoft is invested over here. Like this, we talk about structuring a lot. And it's really interesting when we put up a structuring workshop. We don't get a lot of founders sign up because it's seen as
boring
and it's, I don't have time for that, or whatever version of I have other priorities. But the reality is these types of structural issues, systemic issues, like these matter, because the way they can lead to conflict, they can lead to conflict of interest, they can lead to poor management and underperformance. But I was really fascinated when I saw this structural setup.
Structure achieves strategy, right? And the silly example that I've given before is, let's say that Don wakes up one morning with the vision and the mission to be a male supermodel, and he gets external validation. His mum says, Donovan, you're a beautiful boy. And he says, you know what? I'm just going to do it. That's my vision. That's my mission. Anybody that has met me knows that this is not the structure of a male supermodel, in a whole range of reasons. Now, I can either keep persevering and then end up with a lot of internal conflict because my vision just isn't being achieved despite how much I want it and how much passion I've got for it, or I've got to change my structure. I could go and get leg extensions, lose 20 kilos, facelift. That's probably not even enough at this phase. I'm not even sure I could be a hand model. I think they'd reject that, right? So maybe I can change my structure to achieve my mission, or maybe I've just got to get rid of my mission or change my mission and vision. And once you have kids, your mission and vision is just to slide into a relative obscurity of dad bod. And I submit that my structure is meeting that vision and mission tremendously. And so with an OpenAI, the problem is when you've got conflicting missions and visions all within then a conflicting structure, like the board and the type of governance and the people that you need for a charity is totally different to others. And you've got people that have clearly demonstrated to be incredibly smart. This is not an intelligence thing, but actually it's an experience thing. It's an EQ thing. It's factors that I would just submit that this board didn't have, and therefore there was a structural problem that meant one day there was always going to be a problem. And that's often the problem with breakups, that actually they're seeded from day one. You don't feel them, you don't see them until some conflicting thing happens, and then it blows up.
Yeah.
And in this instance, the problems were seeded way back when OpenAI was developed. The problem seems to have been Sam's wandering eye on other opportunities that maybe they did put OpenAI's IP at risk. Maybe he was being self-centered. Maybe this was not tenable. That could have been correct. But how they've gone about it, I humbly submit, is going to destroy OpenAI, and it's going to be bought by someone, most likely Microsoft. I agree with a lot of the commentary that they're going to pick this thing up for pennies, because it's widely talked about that Microsoft has invested $10 billion. Not all of that is vested, and a lot of that was in-kind processing power. And if we think of what AI really is, it's some smart stuff on top of unbelievable amounts of processing power that we've now got in this day and age. You take away the processing power, you're in a whole lot of trouble. So now Altman gets to go to Microsoft, which was the processing power for OpenAI, and if he can drag some resources. But what happens in companies when these things go off? We've spoken about integration and disintegration before. A company, when there is destructive conflict, starts to disintegrate, and all the energy goes into that conflict and no energy is left to go and do the thing that it's designed to do. So in a fixed energy world, 100% is 100%. And it's something that Ishak Adesis has spoken about for a long time. It's energy is predictably allocated, and it first goes to conflict, and then you can't get anything done.
Yeah.
And so if 25% of your energy is being consumed by conflict, only 75% can go and sell products, develop products, solve problems. But if you're 90% or 95% consumed by all of this distraction and conflict, you're not getting anything done.
Yeah. And I think, you know, going back to the comment you made at the start there, that even if those things were true about Sam Altman and these other things that he was working on, distractions, and maybe he's not being completely transparent with the board and so on and so forth, measuring the upside versus downside, which is something we talk about a lot, but actually looking at what are the, is that just something that we need to bear and be okay with? Because the downside of making a change like this was far more damaging. And so I think, yeah, Microsoft's a real winner here. They've positioned themselves really well.
They've got to be a little bit careful. Some of the stuff I have seen that I agree with is that Microsoft, with 49% of OpenAI and control in the compute, means that if anything went wrong or hallucinations and all the fuck ups, that can be on OpenAI's brand,
yep,
and not their brand. So now, if they're going to take on this, they're really, it's not exactly beer and Skittles, but yeah.
Yeah, it's not. But then I think in terms of hoovering up that talent, one thing that stood out for me, that the 700 employees of OpenAI obviously have a good loyalty to Sam, because they're calling for him to be reinstated. And if not, they're happy to go to Microsoft. This is obviously...
Yeah, imagine a board that's so disconnected from what's happening in the company that couldn't see
any of that.
That if we just cut Sam out, that we weren't going to get a backlash. Now, there's been some things online that Sam's not exactly the most likable guy for a few people in the ecosystem, but no entrepreneur is, right?
No.
We've got people that love us and simultaneously hate us. The board to not understand the amount of the heart emojis, like all weekend, it's just been a heart emoji love fest, which is lovely to see. But yeah, just the naivety. And to me, it smacks of people that are so purpose-driven, and we see them all the time, and they then get caught up in this black and white view of everything, when that's just not the world that we tend to live in. There are shades of grey, and even if Sam was in the wrong, then you start a process, you start what's in the best interest of the company, whereas I just smell people have acted in what's in their best interest of their own emotional reactions, and haven't thought about the company. They've just only thought about what makes themselves feel better.
Yeah, there's some news out from Bloomberg overnight that the VC investors are looking to potentially sue the board, because obviously this valuation, what was it valued at? $86 billion in October?
USD.
Yeah.
And USD as well.
Yeah, USD as well. And you're about the employees. Imagine you're an employee, and this was from Pivot this morning or yesterday, and you're getting ready to sell in a secondary transaction that's coming up. As Galloway points out, you can't help but start thinking about all the things you're going to do. Oh, I'm finally going to pay off my parents' house was one of the things. Or I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And then now forthwits have gone and destroyed that for you. And this is the internal disintegration that I talk about, that there's no way the board survives, but this bomb that's gone off, that hurt and that pain and that destructive conflict then just smashes the place. And the question is, if it's going to survive, the cultural revolution that's going to have to occur to keep it intact is going to need to be significant.
It was interesting reading some of the commentary on social media. The AI doomsdayers were saying that this board held the future of humanity in their hands. And there's a lot of people really reacting to that, of how these individuals make this decision. And in their, like in this doomsday scenario view, is that's it. AI's won. We're all dead. Yeah. Which I know is extreme. But it is interesting.
Having just reflected, as I sometimes do, fuck was probably too strong. I more often than not act like a fuckwit when in stress situations. So I shouldn't be so rude. You've got to assume people do the best they can and that they were operating. But this is why you shouldn't put children in charge of heavy machinery. You've either got to have experience and know what you're doing and get some advice. So I recant the quit. Let's just go inexperienced people that should have known better.
Yeah, and I think there's some good lessons for founders. If we share a few, one would be having some sort of circuit breaker or system to detect when you're stuck in a groupthink that's just leading you down a path, like having an advisor, having a diverse board with diverse perspectives, seeking counsel, seeking advice. I think the second one for me here is communicate. We saw the Optus CEO just step down because the full day of the Optus outage didn't make a single statement. Then when she did come out after it was all resolved, made a mockery of small business owners that had been caught out not being able to take payments on because of the Optus outage. I think just these basic fundamentals of overly communicating, particularly in crisis or ambiguity.
But when you're stuck in the painting, you can't see the whole picture. And that's why it's so important to have external people. And I think I mentioned in one of the episodes when the family office had an issue, we called in support from Hannah Moreno and her partner Jeremy to help us. You've got to have people outside that are trying to challenge your thinking.
Yeah.
And bringing different perspectives and saying, yeah, but if you do that, this is what it's going to be. I understand what you're saying and what you're thinking, and you might be right, but that's not the way this plays out. You've just got to have those people that you trust. Otherwise, you get into trouble.
Yeah. Having that external perspective is so valuable, especially when you're in the storm. And I think the third piece of advice for founders out of this, which we talked about, was just looking at your structure. And as boring as it may sound, and as much as it might be something you think of putting off to the future when you resolve some other issues, to Don's point before, we talk about tech debt, but there can be a structural debt that you're carrying as a time bomb that you don't even realize.
There's also another quick lesson here, because I think there's also been a confusion between authority and power. And it often happens that people confuse the two. With the work we do with portfolios, we get them to understand a model that says authority is the obligation and the right to say yes and no to a decision. The reason why that and no is there is that in most organizations, there's lots of people that can say no to anything. Finding that first person that can actually say yes can be a little bit of a challenge. But boards and CEOs, they tend to have a lot of authority, a lot of ability to say yes and no to something. But power is actually those that you need and expect cooperation from. If you tell someone to do something and they say, well, I'm not going to do it. Well, who's got the power in that relationship? Now, maybe you can use your authority to sack them and find someone new, but that takes a lot of energy if you're constantly going around the merry-go-round, firing and hiring and firing and hiring. And I don't think this board has realized how much power Sam has and then how much power the entire organization has. When 550 of the 700 staff sign an open letter demanding your resignation, that's when you really learn that I had the authority to sack Sam, but I certainly don't have the power. And taking it a step further, the next ingredient is influence. There are people in an organization that have no authority, they have no power, but they can sort of influence an outcome. Now, on the positive side of influence, it's because they've got domain expertise, knowledge. We want them involved in the conversation because they really understand something. At the negative side of influence, it's the water cooler folk. It's the people that say, "How have you seen that direction that's come out from on top? Yeah, we're gonna lie down to the feeling passes." And they're able to influence others in the organization to do or not do something. And so when it comes to implementation, what we always try and get people to understand is that authority, power, and influence working together is most likely to get a decision that's going to get implemented. Whereas as authority just runs off totally separate, making a whole lot of decisions and leaves the power and influence behind, they get a tremendous backlash, and we tend to find implementation is really hard. And the work I often do in the scale-up phase with the portfolio company is understanding that authority, power, and influence changes as an organization scales. And when you're really small, authority, power, and influence can be held in a very small team. But as your company gets bigger, authority starts to separate from power, which starts to separate from influence. And what you need to have is systems and processes that when it comes to decision making, when it comes to change, when it comes to implementation, you're always able to get the authority, power, and influence on the same page. Otherwise, that leads to organizational failure. And authority, power, and influence is often not just from people within the organization. If you look at the role Microsoft has played here, they're both power and influence. I mean, given the compute that they bring to OpenAI and then what they were able to do post the sacking of Sam, they've been able to bring tremendous influence and power. I mean, if you think of who do you need and expect cooperation from, well, probably your 49% shareholder, but more importantly, the entity that actually provides the computing power. And for them to be able to then provide Sam with a space where he could then go and probably take hundreds of the OpenAI people just shows that their process didn't first ask who is the authority, power, and influence that we're going to have to bring on board with this decision so the decision is correct. They went off. They used authority alone. They didn't have Microsoft at the table. And so it's just really important for founders, when you're thinking about a decision, always ask, who's the authority? Who's the power? Who's the influence? Who do I expect and need cooperation from? Who could turn against this decision? Who could hamper implementation? Who could stop it? But also, who could enrich it? Who do I need at the table to sort of enrich my decision making, to make me think through all the different aspects that I may not be seeing? So just another little framework or conceptual thing, but I think this is going to be really interesting to watch.
Tribe Global Ventures invests in and supports Australian and New Zealand B2B-focused companies that are ready to expand into the US and or the UK. In addition to investing in companies, we run founder and investor multi-day scale-up offsites where founders and investors come together to scale their companies, as well as running US and UK market entry missions designed to help you understand these international markets and hit the ground running to open operations. Here's what founders and investors have to say.
It was a great sort of temperature check of where the business is at, and that's always helpful because half the time you don't know if what you're doing is what you should be doing.
Getting to spend time with founders in a space that takes you out of the day-to-day, takes you out of the busyness of working in a big city. And I think this location absolutely nails that.
Being together with others, sharing your stories and hearing how similar in some ways they are to everybody else.
And how great has that been?
Yeah, it's really refreshing. Yeah.
I think this weekend's been a really powerful way to just get really clear on what tools work and how could I implement them quickly and effectively into the business.
And the other thing is just the empathy that all these other founders show for one another. I feel like the founder journey, you hear it all the time, can be quite lonely, but I feel like you hear these anecdotes here over the weekend. I think that just helps to bring that to life.
As an investor wanting to make a difference to my portfolio, like I believe that if I can help my portfolio succeed, that's going to increase the enterprise value of those companies. It's going to make them more likely to be able to get to the next milestone. And so there are lots of, you know, really practical tools that I can now use when I'm having a conversation with the startups that I'm invested in to just go, hey, have you thought about this in that way? And so, yeah, I think there's, you know, great opportunity for investors to come along to this, and also gives an investor a great opportunity to meet cool startups.
You can learn from the ones that are a little bit ahead of you.
Knowing that everyone has problems at every stage of the business, it kind of frees you up to de-stress about the problems that you're facing today. And you go, okay, this is normal. I'm not the only one.
We run offsites in February, May, August, and November of each year, and go to the US in March and the UK in June. Check out our events page at tribeglobal.vc to find out more.
Yeah. We've written about it before. There's a couple of blogs that we've put out. We did an episode on dysfunctional boards. The reality is the fish rots from the head, and it's just so important to get that right And even, Jack, a topic that you're so passionate about, and Aaron and I are trying to learn to be good people, to learn the art of rugby. But if you look at Rugby Australia as well, through the chair and the board and what's happened there, there's another example of not only some challenges at board level, but people not knowing when to resign, and people who have no chance in surviving seemingly just sticking it out because, again, I am right. I am not wrong. Everybody else is wrong. I'm not going to move.
Yeah, agreed on. That's something we were chatting about earlier, like when is the right time to leave? It probably goes back to when, what was the saying? When you're stuck in the painting, Don?
When you're in the painting, you can't see the whole picture.
Yeah, so that exactly applies here. And it's probably always great to have people outside of the painting to give you some advice.
And where do you think the rugby board went wrong?
Yeah, no, this all came from losing the trust and respect from the states and the public. So they sacked the coach, Dave Rennie, brought in Eddie Jones for a smash and grab World Cup campaign that we did the worst we've ever done. So then Eddie leaves on his own will, and then Hamish was adamant he was staying as chair, but the states got together and called an extraordinary general meeting, and then he lost the vote as chair. But what I found interesting was they actually asked him to stay on the board, but he resigned. So what I think Hamish, he has a commercial background and he helped with getting the broadcasting rights and securing some other big events, but they've now appointed an ex-Wallaby, Dan Herbert, which I'm not sure his experience from the commercial world, but he definitely has the rugby brains. So yeah,
it's just total lunacy. You tell the chairman to step down but stay on the board. Like, it just, you do not want humans that are thrashing around like a hurt crocodile, hanging around like a bad smell. It's just get on with it.
Yeah.
Totally. Like, it's nonsensical. There was one of our interns just got selected for the Junior Wallabies side, but one of the social media posts I saw announcing the team, it profiled the coach more than the players. And it's just those little cultural signals. Yeah, no, this is not a healthy organization. There's some weird decision making that's been going on.
Yeah. Coming back to, so we could probably flog the shit out of boards all day, but coming back to the AI space and the tech space, there was a really great podcast on 20VC with Des Trainer from Intercom. And I must admit, there are some podcasts I listen to once and then some, I call them the multi-bagger. And I think I've listened to this one four times. I think by the 10th time, I will understand.
Well, I normally listen to podcasts at least 1.5 to 2 times, just so I can stay focused, because otherwise I get distracted. But this one, I had to slow down because there were...
I mean, listening to it as in the number of repeats, not the speed. I need to listen to things multiple times so my little brain actually understands things.
I'm the same, Dom. I'm very much the same.
No, I get it. This one, there were just lots of little nuggets of perception that I kept having to note down.
So Des, he puts out a bit of content. There's another really good podcast that I recommend everyone should listen to. It's called Why Startups Succeed, and it was on This Week in Startups. And he just has this really great ability to break down whatever he's talking about, and it's so easy to understand.
Yeah, Why Startups Succeed. No, we'll put that in the show notes because, and he's built a 900 person plus tech company, and when you listen to him, that clarity of thought. But I think the real relevance and why I found it interesting is we are constantly obviously having to evaluate pitches and deals. And it's now, a couple of years ago, it was blockchain bingo. Now it's AI bingo, and trying to work out, is this true AI? Is this scalable AI? Is this defensible AI? But it's also our existing portfolio. And there were some really interesting points in there that he made the view that if you're an investor or a founder, if they're coming to you saying that, it's AI powered, if the majority of the tech stack hasn't actually changed, then there's no way you can call it AI. It's just AI. It's just the existing thing with a few small wrappers. And then the areas he pointed out that he believes are going to have the most disruption is that in an AI world, if there's nothing you would take from either your existing tech stack or a competitor's tech stack in rebuilding a solution to this problem from the ground up, you're in a lot of trouble. And so from even looking at our own internal portfolio, let's say that AI continues on this march, if the companies were starting from scratch in a world of AI and the approach would be totally different, we are going to have a challenge there. And what we've got to do is really support our founding teams to not get stuck in the inertia of what they do and how they do it today, to be able to create an environment where they can throw out the legacy items and be able to simultaneously still maintain their revenues and enough cash flow to survive, but effectively turn the business on its head. And I thought that was just an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think I liked a bit of their discussion around the typical power law for VC investments and the expectation that 70% of the portfolio will probably end up at zero. But they're saying in the world of AI, that could be over 90% of existing investments because of the disruption that's happening. And I liked how there's some obvious stuff in there around AI obviously replacing any sort of if this, then that type logic. But we're seeing a lot of AI pitches, which are essentially just that. There's really no defensibility to it. But what was interesting was how the framing around that, what he called the thick wrapper, like having, whether it's proprietary data sets or proprietary insights, but that is there a human element that's needed or a deep integration across different systems and very domain specific. So he gave an example of in fintech, looking at investment portfolios and integrating with all of your brokers and providers and banking systems, but then providing an insight layer to that. I found it really interesting, some of the framing around questions that founders can ask themselves to look at their tech stack, to look at the opportunity they're facing and to understand the likelihood of potential disruption. I really encourage any founders to listen to it. For me, it is looking at it from the existing portfolio and how do we help our founders navigate the AI change that is occurring.
One of the analogies that I found really helpful, when the iPhone first came out, I had a business in inspections for insurance companies. So I'd have teams of people that would go out to site and take photos and videos of damage. And the first iPhone, if you remember, because of the data issues, you couldn't send multiple photos. So we built an app, the photo app, that allowed you to compress it and then send lots of photos at once. And we put it on the app store and people started buying it. And then, if you recall, there was no torch app. So we made a little torch app. So when the guys were in the roof, they didn't know that need their torch. But Apple inevitably just added those features and those apps. If we were surviving on them, if that was our bread and butter, we were cooked. And the same thing is going to happen with AI. And I think we started to see it in that OpenAI demo day, where overnight billions in AI investment was rendered useless because OpenAI just added that ability and took away some of that proprietary, what Des called the gap filling. They just added some of these gaps. Now, if you can then provide a really thick layer, like a full-blown app that uses all the parts of, say, the iPhone, that then is able to get really sticky customer relationships and then makes it really hard to move, other people may be able to replicate that, but you've got the network's effects, you've got the stickiness, and you've got the value that is deep enough that the underlying technology is not going to try and come in and destroy that use case because it's just a bit too niche.
I think the other little insight in there for me, which resonates, is the experimental budgets for new AI tech starting to dry up. So looking at corporates, but even consumers who were happy to put a little bit of discretionary spend onto trying new AI tools and widgets and gadgets. But yeah, the commentary was that those budgets are drying up now, and increasingly, particularly in the B2B space, corporates are looking for things that AI tools that add real value to the company.
There was, if you recall, remember that time you got that random message from me because I downloaded an AI app integration for WhatsApp. And I think I said to you, can you please tell the team, I typed in there, can you tell the team I'm running late, but in ye olde English?
Yes.
And it just created this. Master McKenzie would like to inform you that he is most sorry. But anyway, I didn't renew that app. Like,
yeah.
I had my phone.
For that?
There seems to be some embedded judgment in that question, Jack, that I'm
like, I'm not surprised.
I'm not surprised. I'm just a bit disappointed. Talk about eroding my own trust and respect. But yes, Jack, I did.
I did. I do remember that message. That was really funny.
Jack's comment, there's no judgment, Don. I judged you ages ago.
Yeah. But yeah, all those little budgets. And so it's only as the economy gets tougher, we're seeing R&D budgets getting really pulled back. The experience that he was sharing, that a lot of founders and companies have gotten what they thought was market product fit and momentum through experimental budgets, but actually they're going to start to flatline. And true market product fit is where you've gotten through the experiment and actually it's become something that's day to day. That's something for us as investors to really understand is, hang on a minute, do we actually have some traction here, or did we get some early experimentation that is not actually going to transfer? And not only that, is this piece of software, I'll give you an example. And the family office has a big allocation to childcare. One of the problems with childcare is we can't really retain staff in a lot of areas because staff join childcare because they think they're going to be educators, but actually the government regs every year turns them more and more into administrators, where they got to fill out these forms, and anytime something small happens, they get the shit kicked out of them. We're finding it really difficult. Now, we got pitched an idea that was an AI tool that took all the regulations. So it was effectively a closed AI and then listened to what was occurring. And then based on the regulation, made a recommendation for what needed to be done. Now, that regulation could either be around some of the learning outcomes. So based on this learning outcome, the exercise you should do with the children is this. And where the time-saving things is, it takes the educator a long time to go through the regs to work out what they should be doing. Then they've got to write it all out. Now, if there's an AI tool making a recommendation of what they should be doing and then can write that into the forms that need to be submitted, and even the parent app, instead of the amount of time, little Johnny was really good today and managed to not bite, all that stuff. Now that got pitched to us, but it's such a thin wrapper and we've got some internal expertise, we've just decided to go and do that. And then the question becomes is, we're looking at our budget and not going too silly with it, because one day the platforms that we use themselves will just bring that functionality out. So the budget that I've set internally, we've got 500 and something staff. We've worked out that if it can save them around about 15 minutes a day and improve quality and make sure that they don't choose the wrong part of the code, when you add that up, we can spend maybe about $100,000 on this and get a return on it really easily. But one day that's going to just become something that the platforms to run the business integrate, I think. And so anybody that's going off to create that to then sell as a really thin layer is probably going to find themselves out of business. And that business I know that pitched to us has raised about $1 million in capital from investors that I don't think is going to get a return because the world is going to swamp them.
Yeah, the other one that came to mind for me was the number of pitches we've seen for every variant of social media ad optimization. And this is something that it started as a consulting service. There'd be individual, and there still are individuals that go and consult time for money to help you optimize your social media ad spend. Increasingly, there's a lot of tools and startups pitching there, but the AI does it better and will ultimately end up just embedded in these platforms.
Yeah.
You will create, much like Adobe now with Photoshop, where you type a few words and it generates the photo for you.
Jack's predictions have come true.
Yeah. You'll type in what you want to achieve and it will go and create the ad and optimize it and run the A-B split tests and everything else all for you embedded in the platform.
Which is the people that fear AI, because we know that humans can be incredibly reductionist and move to a fear-based engagement model. You could just imagine if you say to the AI, I want you to optimize for engagements and just click a button and off you go, there's going to be some weird, depressing shit that gets created by these beasts. The shit that we create is just weird at the moment. Yeah. It's not that depressing, I hope.
But look at media, and I don't want to rant about media, but the way advertising-based media services have just become clickbait and these ridiculous pieces of content. And you could argue the same for politics. It's all been driven by data analysis to the to these extremes, this is the worry, the AI advertising universe. What was interesting in the podcast was when they were talking about if Siri was actually made smart with AI, and the meanwhile, here's Siri listening to me trying to give me recommendations, or maybe to tell me to F off because I said it wasn't smart. but the opportunity for Apple and Google to actually embed where advertising becomes embedded as a service provider in the Siri response. So if I ask, hey, Siri, book me a taxi, it automatically prioritizes a taxi service based on the advertising spend of the particular taxi.
Yeah, whoever's paying the most, which Des then said, in that world, you just give away the hardware for free.
Yeah.
Just hand off the phones, because then you just make the money out of the back end, which, you know, we're looking at a lot of hardware as a service opportunities in our current portfolio and other investments. If you own that connection layer, here, have our phone for free, and you've got a really powerful AI tool where you just say, book me a taxi, and you're going to just call the taxi company that's most willing to pay the highest amount at that point. So you got your phone for free,
yeah,
but the consequences are on the other end.
Yeah, it's interesting looking at when you start looking at IoT plays or phone devices or wearables purely as a communication layer more than anything else. And if you give away that hardware for free, what it enables with the data you're collecting and the other value add you can monetize, it's super interesting for founders to start thinking that way. The other one for me was the opportunity they discussed for Google, where if they took data from particular companies and use it as a revenue source. So in other words, if you search best all-time NBA player, it could actually then bring up responses that say, according to whatever platform or whatever service provider or whatever company just paid Google, here's the answer, which it's a little bit scary again, going back to how do we distinguish fact from, or what's Trump's expression? Fake news from reality. In a world that's AI generated, in a world where advertising is embedded in a way that you're not even aware it's advertising. Like, it does get interesting, but I think bringing it back for founders, there were a couple of questions that I noted out of the podcast, which I think were useful. One was how Des talked about how he operates with his team, any new technology that comes out, presenting it to the team and saying, hey, how can we use this? And if there is a value there, actually starting to embed it into the product stack.
He also had the business structured that had like significant R&D, but really integrated with his different teams. So they had this energy pushing towards trying anything new, but admitted that a lot of it fails, but they had a culture that allowed the failure to occur. So then that way some successes can come out, but they drove product teams and technology to still achieve their outcomes, but really integrated with R&D. R&D wasn't just some weird thing over there. And if it didn't work, they were punished.
Yeah. And the little filter around when looking at that technology and whether to implement it, is this just a nice to have? Is this a fun little widget? Or is there something possible now that wasn't possible before? And I think I like that framing as a little filter question. And then the big one for me was the one you actually shared, Don, when you first shared the podcast in the team channel, which was, yeah, if we started again today, would we build the product or team different with AI? And I think that's a really important question for founders to be asking themselves right now.
Yeah. And it was a good, he was talking about, oh, we're going to use AI to revolutionize email. The problem being is in order to do that at scale, you've got to be able to have a system that can send tens of millions of emails. You've got to have all these different bits. And if you're building something in AI and you wish you had the parts of other parts of the business, you've got a problem there. Those businesses are most likely to be able to take your idea and then add it on to them. Whereas if what you're trying to do is the opposite, where I don't need any of that stuff, I can do it from the bottom up, then you've got a fighting chance. And I thought that was just a really interesting, helpful way of looking at that. If in order to bring your product to market, you need five core bits of the tech stack of somebody else, and you've then got to go and develop that and then add your little secret sauce, you're just probably not going to survive, because you've got to spend so much time just getting to the level of those other players with those tools before you can overlay your bit, and those players would be in a really good position just to overlay your bit.
Yeah, Don, I think a perfect example here is any marketplace that already has critical mass. If for them to bring in AI features that enhances the platform, But if you're a new company trying to challenge the marketplace, you already have to try and reach critical mass for there to be value. Therefore, the marketplace that already has reached that critical mass is in the prime position to enable it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's just important for investors like us to be able to have these frameworks, and we're trying to build some models to help our thinking when evaluating the pitches that we get. Then we need models to help our investee companies evaluate their own product. They put their heart and soul, blood, sweat and tears developing this product. And if any part of AI is going to make it irrelevant, we've got to make sure that we don't have any emotional connection to the past, that they're willing to just cut the head off it to then bend and mold. Otherwise, they will slide into obscurity, which is the problem that Google has. Google, by all accounts, has become a massive bureaucracy, and it is going to need to eat itself most likely in order to survive here. But the problem is Google is a big group of people with big incentive structures and remuneration structures. And if I just hang around here for another few years, I can make bank, and then it's somebody else's problem. And that's the way, insert Kodak, insert Blockbuster,
yellow pages.
Like, that's what kills companies, right? That internal inability to manage that change loop. And what's getting in the way? Conflict of interest. Conflict of perceptions. AI is not that big, or people will still be doing this in this particular manner. Conflict of roles, conflict of styles, all of those things. That's what kills a company. And that's why young companies often have the ability to beat Goliath, because they don't actually have those internal conflicts that stop decisions and implementation.
Behavioral incentives. The other piece of newsworthy content from the week came from TechCrunch, talking about Australia's place on the global innovation map. And when I was first reading this, it was a little bit of, oh, look, we've just discovered Australia has some startups. But it is actually quite interesting and positive about the Australian
innovation system. Cynical.
Hey, I'm normally Mr. Anti-Cynical, but no, it is a good little positive article about the state of the Australian startup ecosystem. Some broad stats: nearly 1300 scale-ups and 50 scalers, which they define as 100 million plus in that's in financing. Sydney and Melbourne still leading the way, which we know from all the data, still attracts the majority of investment funding as well. But yeah, it's good to see some recognition on a global stage.
Yeah, and then that, because then dovetailed into then another article about those big scale-ups, so the unicorns are defying the global odds at the moment.
Yeah, so this article was in the AFR talking about the big raises by Canva, Employment Hero, Go One, Safety Culture. So our unicorns outperforming compared
to... They're all rushing to add AI, and I have a feeling that those unicorns that survive is because they've got all of these parts of the tech stack and the marketplace, and the network effects keep them connected to their customers and allow them to add on. Although Des in that podcast did point out the functionality that Canva and Adobe are building is starting to become ubiquitous, where you just start telling the system, this is what I want. And as long as it's got workflows and way of storing digital assets, that technology is probably going to become ubiquitous. So I'm going to be really interesting to see how Canva and Adobe fight this out, and whether they can actually maintain growth and gross margins to justify the valuations and the investment to date.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to see what Adobe does if they do become more, I guess, broad consumer orientated for the naive punter who doesn't have any creative ability, just like me, which, yeah, they've brought out some tools that do that.
Yeah.
But then there was also news, and another one of Australia's tech unicorns and successes was Technology One. So full year profits up 16%, covered in an article in Capital Brief this week.
Yeah, Adrian DeMarco, the founder, is, as we've had him on a couple of times, he's a venture partner of Tribe, which we're very grateful for, and a shareholder in the GP. And it's just great to see he has set up this beast that just, if you look at the chart of growth each year, dividends each year, he just has this machine. And the two podcasts we've done and another one will be released soon just give a masterclass on the thinking of how you do that. Because normally in tech, it's growth but no dollars, or it's dollars but no growth. He's been able to be the triple threat of revenue growth, him and the team, obviously, revenue growth, profit growth, cash flow and dividends. It's just talking about a real unicorn.
Yeah, and the fact that it's continued after his departure as both CEO and chair, that's full credit to what has been built there.
Right. Yeah. Well, strong body in motion tends to stay in motion. Sorry, Jack.
Oh, I love it's the 14th year in a row of record profit and revenue.
In a row.
Yeah. In a row. Incredible.
Yeah. No, it is. That's incredible. So that's this week. What are we looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to this afternoon jumping in the car to go and see Mick Dempsey, one of our shareholders and venture partners.
Yeah.
So it'll be a flying visit, but always good to catch up with Mick.
Yeah, that'll be good to head down the coast. My favourite bit's the traffic.
I am worried about the drive back to get the kids in time. But anyway, we'll deal with that.
I'm looking forward to just catching up with some mates and family in Adelaide and then back on Tuesday and then catching up with you guys.
The season, right, at the moment, if you look at the calendar, it's all the Christmas parties and different events. And what's coming up, there's the 10-13 one, 10-13 yeah. Runway conference next week that I've got to organise a leave pass for. There's the FinTech Queensland. That's this week, actually, Christmas event. There's
the Brisbane Angels event.
Yeah, Brisbane Angels event. Merry Startmas with Startmate down at
the Goldie.
Down at Burleigh. We're holding some Christmas drinks in Brisbane on the 5th. Any investors out there? We're going to be at our office, which is Felons Brewery.
There's also the Sunny Coast drinks, the Byron Bay drinks, and another Brisbane drinks by Startmate. And for some reason, I think six of them are all scheduled on the same day, same time. But
and this is coming back to the earlier point, right? Structure achieves strategy, and then behaviours drive structure as well. So the behaviours around all this drinking and eating continues to manifest dad bod. And structurally, that means I'm going to achieve everything I hoped as a ageing father.
We'll be running a lot in January, Don.
Yeah, I've been looking at your Strava, buddy, and you're falling a bit behind. I don't want to. I'm not that guy, and I'm not going to talk about the three runs that I've done this.
My last 7 days have been terrible.
We'll see you soon.
Hey, guys.
Everyone.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. For more information, go to www.tribeglobal.vc. And if you're still here, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave a rating and a comment on the podcast. See you next episode.